We continue the webinar series of BNC, the Budapest Neutron Center. My name is László Botyán. I'm responsible for the seminar series in BNC. This series is about pulse photon sources and applications. We already learned from the previous webinar that short pulsed analytical radiation of high intensity enables us to study evolution of chemical, biological processes, structural transformations, and this opens a field of exciting research of reactions that have been far too rapid to capture by formal methods. Hungarian researchers have successfully contributed to the construction of the X-ray light source and the European X-ray free electron laser. And they gained regular access in these to these European infrastructures. By this series of webinars, with the help of our distinguished presenters, we look deeper into this field to learn about the principles, applications, and future promises of the advanced photon sources, pulse photon sources. As you remember, 2 weeks ago, our speaker was Gyula Fajga from Wigner Research Center, member of the Hungarian Academy of Sciences. Those who missed the webinar of Gyula may play back the video recording from the BNC webpage. Our speaker today will be Professor Robert Feigenhansel. Professor Feigenhansel is a physicist, managing director of the European X-ray Free Electron Laser Facility, the newest and most powerful pulse X-ray source, which has recently turned into user operation. EUXFEL may have an important impact on research in natural sciences in Hungary in the future. Therefore, Professor Feigenhansel was invited to visit prominent research institutes conducting research in the respective fields in Hungary by Dr. István Szabó, Vice President of the National Office for Research Development and Innovation. But due to the pandemic, Professor Feigenhansel's personal visit became impossible. Therefore, he now pays a virtual visit to Hungary to meet the interested colleagues. This is a special opportunity for us in BNC to have Robert with us and have the chance to integrate his lecture in this webinar series on the subject. I will not list here his past professional activities and affiliations. I refer to his Wikipedia page instead. Link is on the BNC webpage. And now we are glad to have Dr. István Szabó, Vice President of the NKFIH, and ask him to open the session with his remarks. Within the somewhat changed governmental system, Dr. Szabó has long been responsible for research infrastructures in Hungary and also for participation of Hungary in international large-scale research infrastructure. We apologize in advance that he will have to leave us very soon for another meeting. So, Dr. Szabó, please.
Thank you very much for your opening words and the short introduction. Actually, the meeting I have to leave is for another research infrastructure for the European spallation source, because there we try to achieve actually pretty much the same as in the case of EUXFEL, namely the to have a much more major portion of potential in-kind contribution to the building of the ESS, because that's what we actually contracted ESS some years ago. EUXFEL is actually one of the first infrastructures Hungary joined. The first and biggest one actually was CERN back in the 90s, and after that came EUXFEL as well. Not immediately, of course, so it took some time, but still we are members in EUXFEL. Since then, we have joined quite a few another infrastructures as well. So this means that currently, basically in all scientific disciplines, we have a related international research infrastructure, which puts a very good perspective to Hungarian scientists to bring their research to more international level. and we consider the Hungarian Research Infrastructure Network mostly as a sort of training grounds or proving grounds for conducting research in these excellence centers in the case of international research infrastructures. Now we luckily have our own flagship infrastructure in this matter, the ELI, which obviously everybody knows of. And the case with EXFA is now currently that we know that it's an excellent infrastructure, but at the same time, we also have to convince the scientific community to use it for the most broader part, actually. Because to put it or to simplify the issue with EXFA from the Hungarian policy perspective is that it was built by physicists for the biological and for the health sciences mostly, and the life sciences or health sciences doesn't necessarily understand what EXFA's possibilities could be. And we are trying to achieve some bridging or some communication with this other scientific discipline, because most infrastructures are usually made for a single discipline. Nowadays, it's quite obvious that infrastructures like EXFA are the future, basically, which could be more multidisciplinary. And also science itself actually needs more disciplinary connection than previously, so not a single discipline will provide the answer to everything, but the methods and solutions used in certain disciplines could be used by other disciplines as well, and that will basically bring a new solutions for the research and development questions. I think that it's a common challenge to have the researcher community understand what EXFA is about, what is the importance of EXFA, and what are the opportunities. And that's why I'm very happy to have Professor Feiderhans with us. I'm pretty sure he can provide us a really deep insight on what are the possibilities of EXFA. And I would like to ask each participant of this webinar, though it's not the most effective way for collaboration and cooperation building, but nevertheless, I would encourage everybody to spread the news of EXFA, especially to other disciplines as well, because it basically, this is the one of the main points of EXFA and this whole meeting. So I thank you very much, and I wish you a very fruitful event.
Thank you very much. I ask now Robert to give his seminar, and I ask the participants to switch off their microphone. Anytime they want to talk, they are allowed to switch on. So I'm now switching off. So Robert, please, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And first, thank you very much for inviting me to give this presentation here. I have been looking forward to that. I must admit, I have been looking even more forward to have it done in Hungary. And I hope that this year will not be substituting a visit maybe next year at some point to engage with the Hungarian user community and also to visit many of the important institutes and universities that do or could actually involve in European EXFA. So I would hope that I will still have the chance to come next year and talk to you in person. And but I will tell you a little bit about European EXFA. I call it a title, a new user facility. User means that we need the engagement from users, meaning you. We do fundamental science, and we do it on ultra short timescales, which I think Giulio Feigl already presented, I think was last week or the week before. Now, on this picture here, you see, first of all, our opening on the left side, this laser on the at the Elbphilharmonie on the left side. You see an overview of European EXFA in the middle. And you see here the management board and so on, very nicely dressed. What you see, there you go. This is how we look today, because like you, I also saw that some of you had masks on. I mean, Hungary is also hit heavily by the by the pandemic, but I want to show this picture because we actually still operating. We had user experiments last week, and we even have users on site in a limited amount, but the people who are able to come to Hamburg or Schleswig-Holstein are actually can also participate in the experiment. So activities are actually still going on during these difficult times. I forgot to mention in my introduction here that I'm actually a professor at Copenhagen University in Denmark. I'm from Denmark, and I heard that you are heavily engaged in the ESS. And of course, when I was in Copenhagen, I was also engaged in the ESS. And I think this combination of synchrotron radiation, neutron science, and Friedrichshafen laser science is a very strong combination of tools that are of interest for a wide range of communities. And I think one should not only look at the X-ray community, the neutron or the X-ray, because I see that there's a certain mix that people shift between the different techniques. And maybe if you have a Hungarian X-ray and neutron scattering organization, that would be of interest for me to actually get in contact with them, hopefully when I would be able to come to Hungary. Now, I will tell a little bit about the what is actually European X-ray. So I'll be more on the machine side, the technical side, a little bit about the history, and then also how does it actually work and what science can be done. And in the outlook, I'll also come a little bit in how one could engage, what are the possibility of engaging with European X-ray. But I think everybody always ask, you know, they want to understand what is the setup, what is the facility, basically see the machine. And if you have an opportunity to come to Hamburg, you should definitely come and visit, because it's much better to see the European X-FIRL live. There are also tools to see it online, but it's much better to actually be here and sort of feel and smell it. So here's the general layout of European X-FIRL. I mean, I suppose many of you have been at Deja or at least heard about it. So can you see my mouse actually? So this is Deja over here to the lower right. And then this is the Hamburg, and all to the lower, to upper left, we have European X-FIRL in Schenefeld. And you see this dashed line here is the border between Hamburg and Schleswig-Holstein. Now it starts here at DESY, where we have an electron injector that injects electrons into this 2 kilometer long linear accelerator. You see a picture of the linear accelerator here, consisting of 96 modules. This is one module here. So that accelerates the electrons up to about 17.5 GeV. We actually have a certain range of possibilities, ranging from, we go down to sometimes to 8 GeV, sometimes up to 17.5. And a very special feature here is that it's a superconducting accelerator. So the inner part of the accelerator is constantly at 2 Kelvin actually. Then here in Osterverborn, after 2 kilometers, when electrons are coming here, you then have the switching station that you can switch the electron beam into two different tunnels. And then by X-ray mirrors, you can then feed X-rays into 5 different tunnels. Via undulators, you see the undulators are here. And the undulators are not like a synchrotron, but they're only 5 meters. Here we have it 150 meters. So it's a really an impressive device, and it works, it simply just works wonderfully. And then here in Schenefeld, we have the experimental hall where all the activities are. And up here on the upper left, you see these are the photon transport system with transport the photons from the undulators into the experimental hall. So we have about 1 kilometer of photon transport where we basically it's the transport is in vacuum, and then we manipulate with mirrors or with focusing devices the X-ray beam. So this is sort of the overall layout, and a little bit in the principle here's a very sketchy thing. This is the overall principle on the accelerator. You have the injector here with a laser shooting on the electron, the low emittance gun here. You produce electrons, say go for a LINAC, they're accelerated, then you bunch them because they have to be very short. You have to lock, you have to compress the electrons in length so they are extremely short. You have another LINAC here, and then you have the undulator, and then in difference to a synchrotron, after they have emitted, the X-rays are coming out here, you put electrons into a beam dump and throw the electrons away. In a synchrotron, you would circulate them around and reuse electrons and again and again, but here you simply dump them. And then you have a very strong X-ray beam coming out here. I will come back to that. So, but this is sort of the overall very simplistic picture of how it actually works. And then I just want right from beginning to say, what is the difference between synchrotron radiation, which, you know, ESRF or DAISY or other places, as a picture here on the left of a picture-free synchrotron radiation facility, and on the right here, the free electron lasers. And the difference here is given by this sketch in the middle, where you see the blue line here is the X-ray beam you get from a synchrotron, about 10 to the 9 photons, and about the length of the photon beam coming out in time is about 100 picoseconds. Whereas for the free electron laser, you have 10 to the 13 photons, so four orders of magnitude more photons in the pulse, and it's much shorter. You see, it's 100 femtoseconds and not 100 picoseconds. Actually, it's more typically like a few tenths of femtoseconds, maybe 20 or 30 femtoseconds. So it's much shorter. And if, of course, the 100 femtoseconds is the time scale of interest if you want to look at atomic motions. So this is sort of an extremely important time scale, and the pulses come exactly with that length. So we can study dynamic phenomena on atomic time scale. And this is what the whole basis of European X-FIL is for the scientific outlook. This is what you should do. This also makes a extremely strong beam, because we have 10 to the 4 more photons on a factor of maybe a factor of 1,000 shorter time scale. So if the X-ray beam hits a focused X-ray beam hits a target like a piece of metal, I've shown here on the left side a piece of steel, 5 centimeter, then it's so strong that it will basically drill a physical hole through the steel. And it takes, in this case here, it took for this particular experiment less than half a minute, then you had a hole through the steel. So it's a very strong beam. You can see here, see on the right, you can see the exit hole and the entrance hole. The exit hole is only 30 microns. I think the beam here was focused to about 10 microns. And what happens is that the beam is so strong that it creates a plasma which then evaporates. So if you sort of in short, it's nearly impossible to stop the focused beam. So if you have some beam shutters, etc., should not be placed where you have the focus beam. So there's a lot of safety concepts around it, but of course, we have that fully under control. It also means that you have a very strong beam, and that if you place your sample there, it's gone. And I will come back to that. So it puts a different set of requirements on what kind of experiments you are doing. It's not synchrotron radiation experiments with more flux. It's something completely different, and that I'll come back to. Now, a little bit about the European X-FIL. We started in 2009. We had the opening in 2017. You saw the picture of the Elbphilharmonie. We have constructed it, we operate, and we also have to develop further the X-ray laser facility. You see, we have Germany and Russia are the big shareholders. Germany 58%, Russia about 27%. Hungary is close to 1, and all the others are of the same order of magnitude, 1 to 3%. So I think Hungary, Slovakia, Denmark are of the about this 1%. Now, we do not operate the accelerator, so we have a very intense and close collaboration with DESI. DESI is the world champion in accelerator physics. They operate, they develop, they construct it, and they operate the accelerator for us, and we have a contract on that. We have about 500 people here on site in Schenefeld, and DESI have about 250 people working at DESI just to run the accelerator. You see here, it was built 50% in cash, 50% in kind. Some of that, a significant part came from Hungary, corresponding to the share. And you see, it's not cheap to run such a facility. So we have a significant operational budget. We also have the Hungarian staff. I just showed this picture here. You can see the staff we have around here, and this is total staff, not only the scientific staff. Roughly half are German. If we have looked at the scientific staff, there will be much more international and less German. You can see in the Hungarians, we have unfortunately only 3 Hungarians here. Maybe that's something what could work on. And in my own country, you see Denmark up on the other side. Here we have 2. But otherwise, there's a lot of Italians, Russian, Polish, UK people actually here working on the facility. And we are extremely happy about that. So it's a very international place, a lot of young people here. So coming to the experimental hall, how do we actually do these experiments? Because that's often a significant question here. So we have 6 instrumental stations, and we call them in Germany, they are very much like short abbreviations. And you see here, you have these 3 letters, the high energy density, material imaging, FXC, SPB, SQS. So these are 6 different instruments. And the way we operate, and I will come back to that, is that we can run 3 instruments at the same time. So typically, we have, let's say, HED, FXC, and SQS working during the day from 8 morning to 8 evening. And during the night, 3 other experiments are running. So over a week, all 6 instruments are actually doing experiments on this. And we work on a proposal-based basis. So you write a proposal. It's going to be evaluated by a scientific committee, give a ranking, and then we try to allocate beam time. Unfortunately, we have a factor of 4 to 5 more proposals than we can actually give beam time. And now I come back to what these instruments are doing. It's actually only one of these 6 instruments which are doing biology. Most of the others are actually doing fundamental physics, chemistry, or material science. So a little bit about how does it actually work. The Friedrichshain laser was independently developed by Saldin in Novosibirsk in the late 70s. And by Pellegrini and his group in the early 80s in the US. And the way it works is that you, it's called self-amplified spontaneous emission, where the electron beam sort of is being bunched. Next slide will show it. And then you amplify your beam, you basically amplify the noise. First principle was but superconducting Friedrichshain laser at low energies was done at FLASH 2005. And there the basic principle was demonstrated that it works. And then people had they were confident that you could also build the bigger facility. In 2009, the first heart X-ray laser laser that was in Stanford. That is a facility which is based on warm technology. So it's not superconducting. And I'll come back to the differences. And then, we were inaugurated. We started as a company in 2009, you see. I must admit, I don't know who the Hungarian representative is, but there must be somebody here who signed the the convention in 2009 as a person from Hungary. What happens is that what in order to have a laser effect, you need to convert a non-coherent electron bunch. You have electrons there, the blue ones, they emit light, and on the left you see an incoherent bunch, they are not really structured. In a coherent bunch, you see on the right, the electrons have been aligned to a certain lattice, and then they amplify themselves. So your intensity coming out is the square of the amplitudes, not the sum of the intensities. And the way it works here, and this was described, Saldin, Pellegrini, etc., was that you have lasing in long one pass, self-amplified spontaneous emission, that you see here an electron beam on the here in the middle on this bunch here, which is very homogeneous. It comes into the undulator. It's very short, so it's very intense. There's a lot of power in it. Then as you go along the undulator, it emits light, the X-ray light. The X-ray light then modulates the feedbacks on the electron beam. So it's get modulated, and this modulation length here is exactly the wavelengths of the light. That means that now electrons are coherently aligned. And then when you come to the end of your undulator, then they emit full power. A lot of power is coming out, the photon beam is coming out, and you put the electron beam into the beam dump, as I said in the beginning. Now, this is a process that starts up from noise, so it depends on the fluctuations in the electron bunch as it comes in. Here's actually another picture. The electron cloud, you see the size of the aligning of the electron bunch, and then it's micro bunch, you get saturation and a strong beam out. And I think the next one I would show here is the since it starts up from noise, every pulse is different. Every pulse is different, so it's not like a synchrotron. And here you can see we have actually measured pulse by pulse over 200 shots. We have many shots coming out. We have, 27,000 pulses a second. And here you can see we have done an energy spectrum pulse per pulse. And you see every pulse is different. And that is, of course, something you have to take into account in your data analysis, in the way you set up the experiment, that every pulse is different. We are right now have extremely successful schemes in doing self-seeding, where the pulse are much more similar, but we have not really offered that to the user community so far. So this is a very important difference you should remember. Here's the undulators, just to show you some exciting hardware. We have in total 450 meters magnetic length. And it just works extremely reliable. It's a lot of engineering. It has to be kept at a certain temperature, but it simply works. We have two hard X-ray sources and one soft X-ray. Hard X-ray means they work between 10 and 20 kV. Soft X-rays, they are about 500 EV to about 2 or 3 kV. So, and the way it works is, and I think this is very particular for European X-Well. That's why I show this technical detail here. We have a bunch structure. So we have the pulses are coming in bunches. So you start with the electrons here on the upper here, you see these lines here. And then you have basically a traffic police who are directing where should the electron bunches go. So then you have the blue ones here coming, they go through this undulator here, SARS-3, we have three undulators. And then you say, okay, I need the first 100 pulses coming, go through SARS-1. Then you put something in SARS-3. They go through SARS-1 into SARS-3, and then you can get some of them to lace and some not. And then you use the TLD, it's a beam dump here to optimize again, and then you may put the rest of the electron bunches into SARS-2. And we have 10 bunches per second, and each bunch have 2,700 pulses here. And then we can distribute, and there again, the interaction with the users is very important, because every user wants a different bunch pattern, a different, maybe a different charge, different energy. So we really need to discuss with the users their requirements for doing the beam and plan accordingly. So it's again, it's different from using a synchronization source where you basically get the same every day and every week. So we have other facilities around the world. You have the LCLS at Stanford. I said that 2009 it started. We have SACLA in Japan. You have Swissfell in Switzerland starting 2016, and you have PALFEL in Korea. And if you see the one important goal numbers here is the number of pulses per second. They have about 100 pulses per second, no, 60 to 120, where we have up to 27,000 pulses per second. So we can generate many more pulses per second than they can. And that's important because for many of the experiments we do, statistics is important. We need a lot of statistics. I'll come back to that. Now, LCLS has decided to, they are actually upgrading now, so they also built a superconducting LINAC in order to get this high pulse rate. And the Chinese are also building a superconducting accelerator in Shanghai. That will be ready in, I don't know, five to 8 years. But the LCLS is started commissioning after the rebuild. So I said that again, I will just repeat here, the key parameters is this burst mode where we have burst or bunches coming with 2,700 pulses, 600 microseconds in total, 220 nanoseconds between them if we use all the pulses, and then you get these bursts 10 times a second. And that's important when we come to the data collection afterwards. It's a technical detail, but we really want to exploit that the features of European X-Fell is this megahertz, which, as you said, because this is megahertz repetition rate, there's a lot of bunches coming, and we go up to very high photon energies. We have actually had lasing up to 30 kV already. So we can up to very high energies, which is also not possible at any of the other facilities. I already said what the difference was. Ultra short, very intense. That is what X-ray filter lasers provide. Now, coming to what kind of science could be done. Then, as I said, when I showed this piece of steel, you have a very strong beam which penetrates everything. So what happens if you put a sample into the beam? And here was a simulation done 20 years ago, actually, by Richard Neutsche, Edgar Weckert, Janos Haido, where they said, what actually happens if I put one protein into the beam? And you see here, you have a protein coming in, and then you can see the X-ray beam hits at time zero, and then you can see that the sample explodes. Cannot take the beam. As I told you, we drill a hole into a piece of steel. Exactly the same happens with your sample. It explodes. The trick is you need to be able to take the data before it explodes. And you can see here, some tenths of femtoseconds is the right time scale. Then you can still take a picture and or a scattering image and see this was coming from the undisturbed protein from the beginning. This principle was tested in a groundbreaking experiment by Henry Chapman and collaborators at FLASH in 2006. It's not a protein. What they did was that they took a sample consisting of a picture engraved in silicon. You can see 1 micron, so it's absolutely not atomic scale. They used it at FLASH where you have softer photon energies. You took then you put this into the beam, took one pulse coming from the flash, got this scattering picture. From this scattering picture, you could then reconstruct the image of your original sample. And then you can see it was possible to actually take an image of the sample before it exploded. The second pulse was this one here, which is very different from the first one, because if you look at the lower right, the sample has completely gone. So it explodes, but you can collect data before it's destroyed. And that was the important message.
Hey,
So the experiments we do are now done in a, and I think this is important to note, in a radical different manner than from a synchrotron experiment. So what you do is, here's a sketch we got from some of the users. This is, you have the green ones here are crystals coming into the beam. This here with this kind of thing here is you have a pulse structure. In this case, it, you have 7 pulses per burst. And then for every pulse, you collect a scattering image of a crystal. You don't know what the orientation is. It's a random crystal. You have no clue what the orientation is, but you collect a scattering image over here. And from, let's say, 10,000, 100,000 of these scattering images, you can then construct what is the structure of these proteins, even if they are not identical. And I think that's a very different way. You just collect data, and I'll come back to how much, and then you sort out the interesting result afterwards, instead of really fine-tuning your precious sample and measure it for a week. You just take many samples and then collect the entire ensemble and figure out afterwards. So the samples are coming in. Here is in a jet. Here's a typical jet where you push in a liquid, or you spray the samples into the vacuum chamber. And you can see here, these interruptions are when the X-ray beam hits the jet, because when the X-ray beam hits the jet, it evaporates and breaks the jet. But you can see that it's still a regular fashion. So you, and the data also shows that the that there's no interaction between the different pulses. You can sort of trust that the data are independent of the rep rate. So the one of the scientific cases is that you want to make, we call it molecular movies. You have a jet of a sample come into the beam. You take a scattering image. And then you, from many of these scattering images, you can then collect the structure of the protein. Then you take, if you want to do a molecular movie, you have it on the left. You have a protein, you have an orange optical laser exciting the protein. And then shortly after, the blue X-ray beam is coming in. And then for every time step, you can then take maybe 10 or 100,000 scattering images. And then you can collect the structure of the protein as a function of delay time, the time between the orange and the blue pulse. And then you could maybe do a molecular movie where you can then see what happens for a particular protein after excitation with an optical light. And the first measurement of this sort was this one here. It was published not too long ago. Time result, several femtosecond crystallography at European Exwell. Note also how many people are on the proposal. So how many co-authors are. It's again a difference from synchrotron relation. You work in, at least at the moment, in much bigger groups than you do for a typical synchrotron experiment. And here you can see the time structure from data combined here, European Exwell at LCLS, where you see what actually happens here this is the photoactive yellow protein, which is being excited by light, and then you can see the changes in the structure. So this is the kind of experiment we want to do. You can see the time scale here is this is before, this is 3 picosecond up to 100 picosecond. So we can start to follow the process, and we of course want to push it to even shorter time scales. And this is the way the experiment were actually done. You have the jet here, you have the data here, and then you from the data you can then calculate. There's somebody who's typing very hard on his computer. Could I get everybody muted?
Yeah. Can you please switch off the microphones?
Yes, I think there's somebody who's typing hard on his keyboard. Good. So the phenomena you want to look at on here's a time scale where you see what kind of phenomena you want to look at, I mean, all of the, you know, about a nanosecond, etc. That's something you can do at a synchrotron. With a Fresnel laser, you really have to focus on what is special and particular for a Fresnel laser. And these are the shorter time scales, atomic motions, transitions. We just saw that electronic transition, energy transfer, you know, electrons to lattice, how heat is being generated, etc. So this is the interesting time scales. You can see synchrotrons and X-fills. So here's again the general layout, and here's the photon beamlines. And here's another one I want to tell you about, because the complexity of experiments is higher than it is at a typical synchrotron experiments, because we have a huge amount of data. We collect a lot of data because you have these very, very many pulses. You have 2D scattering data. You need to do the data analysis in order to get the results out. And then you have diagnostics, optics, optical laser, assembly delivery. So there's a lot of things that actually can go wrong. But there's also many cases where it goes quite well. Here's one of the main challenges, namely the detectors and the detector calibration. So here's the detector from one of the instruments. We have it's a 1M detector, 1 million pixels. You have the particular pulse structure here. And the pulses come so fast that you cannot read out the detector and store the data between every pulse. So what it does is here that it takes 352 frames within one bunch structure here. And then when there's no pulses coming, you read out the detector. And that gives you a lot of data. And the detector is a key part of the whole facility. So they are the detector calibration, the data analysis, all that is a major effort. It's much more demanding than you get at a synchrotron source. And here you can see the data volumes which we have collected here in petabyte. So it's a lot of data, and you can see every time we have users. So here's nothing happening. Hope you can see my cursor. And then you get these vertical lines that when we actually take data. So we collect a lot of data, and that's of course a challenge for the users who come to handle and analyze all this data. And there we try to collaborate. So I told you about the instruments. You can see some of the 6 instruments here. I'll just go very quickly through them. You have the instruments here, femtosecond X-rays on the FXC instrument, bioimaging, materials, high energy density science, small quantum system, spectroscopy, and coherent scattering. And I also listed the group leaders. And I want to say, if you want to submit a proposal, want to collaborate, you have to the best way is to contact some other people who are you already know there, or you talk to the team leader here, the group leader Anders Madsen, Mancuso, etc. So here is just to show you, this is on SPB. This is an experiment where they did not look on proteins, but they put in gold particles. So they were shooting in gold particles in the beam to see, you know, how much data can they actually collect? And they collected, you know, lots and lots and lots of scattering images. And from these scattering images, you can then you can then construct an ideal scattering image. You can see here, they got 10 million different images. And when you have collected all these images, then you can then see the gold particles are not the same. And then after you have collected all the gold particles, by looking at the each scattering images, you can then start to sort them into how big are the crystals and what shape do they have. You can see over on the very left here that they are quite different. So the samples are not the same, but having enough data, you can sort out afterwards what was it you actually were looking at. And that is what I mean with it's a radical different approach. And I think this is something which you could look for in material science, small clusters where you look at many different clusters, could be aerosols, and then after you've done the experiment, you then sort out what did you actually look at. 10 million data. Another experiment is on SCS. SCS is this coherent scattering experiment at low energies, and there one of the main scientific directions is magnetic systems. So they look at small angle scattering, in this case on magnetic system, with a new detector here, and they look at the ultrafast nucleation and coalescence of magnetic fluctuations. And this was done here. The leading scientist, the leading group was led by Igor Pronin from St. Petersburg, the ITMU University. So magnetism is a very important field here. We also have a small quantum system, which is also on the soft X-ray beamline, where they do multi-photon spectroscopy imaging, coincidence measurements. And this here there's a lot of extremely fundamental quantum physics they are doing here, nonlinear physics. And I'm really looking forward to sort of see when they start to push the limits on quantum physics that they are doing here. We have high energy density, which is a super important and super exciting field where you look at matters under extreme conditions. So here you have a diamond envelope cell where you look at a sample which is pressed into high temperature and high pressure. Then you come in with your X-ray beam, and then you can see this could be where you push together the diamond envelope cell statically, and then you, by a picture actuator, you can then give a last very fast additional increase, and then you could then with the X-ray beam, because you have these many pulses, you can then follow what actually happens as a function of time. You could also use the X-ray beam itself to heat the sample, because there's a lot of power, you saw it in beginning, and see how this plasma is actually created. And there's a lot of really exciting science going on here on these kind of samples here. Some first experiments that were actually done half a year ago. People are extremely excited about that. Here's one of my favorite. I see time is running a little bit, so I will hurry up. This is a user group from Göttingen. They look at how do you create water bubbles. No, you put in a high power laser into a glass capillary. This laser creates water bubbles, and then you follow how are these water bubbles actually created, and what is the structure of the water bubble, what's the density of water as a function of distance away from the center of the water bubble, and then you follow that as a function of time. So it's a fundamental science, but important also for technical applications. We have also had a user experiment on FXC, which is mainly chemistry, where you look on chemical reaction. And FXC is the instrument which has a lot of, or not a lot, but they have Hungarian users to look at this chemical reaction in the particular in liquid systems. This is from Eli Alps and the Wigner Institute. Okay, so now I'll give you an overview of what kind of activities are done. So how to take part in these activities? First of all, I would encourage you to take part in our users meeting, which will be even more easy than it normally is, because unfortunately it will be all online in January 25 to 29. There are lots of parallel sessions, but of course in a normal year, I would encourage you to come and talk to the staff and the other people. You can also gauge by European Expert. I mean, we would encourage sabbaticals if people would say, I want to learn more and I will maybe spend half a year or something like that, that we could maybe find out ways how we could support that. We're also looking into possibility of joint PhD positions. So if you come with half, we could come with half or something like that. Before writing a proposal, you have to contact the scientist at the instrument you're interested in, or you can write to me or any others. It's always, you could also write to some of the Hungarians we have here. And you could also investigate the possibility of joining a community proposal. You've seen some of these proposals have quite a lot of participants, and it's possible we sometimes make quite often do community proposals where we take everybody on board so everybody can actually participate. It's a little bit difficult at the moment with COVID, so you might not be able to come on time, but we can hope that that's going to change. And you couldn't, we also have a biolaboratories or sample laboratories where you can come and make tests and sample preparation before you actually do the experiment. You also have to write an appealing and exciting proposal. We have a proposal review panel consisting of experts. There's also Hungarians. Some of your colleagues are actually on some of these proposal review panels, but unfortunately or fortunately, the rejection rates are high. And all six instruments are in use operations, so they are doing a lot of science. You have here again the names. We have already publications coming out. There are you can look at our websites to see. It's typically at the moment SPB, but you're, because that was one of the first instruments starting, but the others are catching up quite rapidly. Here is one of FXE, and this is actually with a Hungarian PI, Sophie Canton from Eli Alps. Here's also one from FXE, from SQS. So you see there's a lot of publication coming out. And here's a picture of happy users in 2019. Unfortunately, these users do not look so happy in 2020. Because we didn't have very much beam in the spring due to the COVID. They now start to look happier in the fall because we started user operation again in August. So here's a summary how many experiments we have done, how many proposals. You can also see here's again a different view on the big data rates we are having. And then I was also I was asked to say a little bit about possible collaborations other than on scientific levels. There is a possibility also for collaborating on technical developments. We have announced this EU tender, so there's a possibility in particular for companies, and we would also very much like we engage with the industrial liaison officer in our shareholder countries to tell them about the possibility on how things could be done, how you could collaborate with us, and here's some of the things that we are actually working on. You can see the procurement budget for 2020 to 2024, 300 million euros. So there's a lot of possible ways of collaborating, but it has to go over the procurement. And with that, I would like to stop here and say thank you very much for listening. There'll hopefully be a lot of questions. And I also want to thank the staff at UP Nexfeld and at DAISY, because these people here do a tremendous amount of work to get the instruments and to work, and that we can actually do the user experiments only 3 years after we really started. So with that, I would ask for questions, and thank you for listening.
Okay, thank you very much for this clear and nice and round presentation. And so please ask your questions. Don't forget to put on your microphone if you want to talk.
Yes, I would have a question. Good afternoon, my name is Janusz Orban. I would like to know the typical sample size, or a solid sample could be put in the sample position, and what can be the typical size of that?
It depends a little bit on what experiments you want to do. Because as I showed you, if you put a solid sample on with a focus beam, you will drill a hole. It will be destroyed. So you have to defocus the beam to make sure that it's not being damaged. And this damage is some of the considerations one has to do when you plan an experiment, that you find the damage threshold where you can measure without damaging the sample. We have done some experiments on perovskite, HGC superconducting light like samples where you can see it works, but you have to worry about the damage. A more typical experiment is that you think in this different way, where you simply have millions of samples and then you only look at them for once, and then they're gone. And then you collect the data and analyze the data afterwards. This is actually what you do in many of our experiments, that the sample do not survive the interaction with one pulse, and then you sort the data afterwards. On SCS, this magnetic scattering, the sample survives, and I think they are they have to be special made, so they will be more on the micron side. But if you have a good experiment, we could in mind also our sample laboratories could help you on maybe preparing or discussing how such a sample could look.
Thank you.
Tomáš Berger raised his hand.
I would like to ask could you tell us what is the energy of the pulse? I mean, a bunch of pulses.
Yes.
Which carries to the sample.
Yes. So we typically, at a synchrotron, you normally look at the electron current in the synchrotron. Here we actually look at the pulse energy, and a typical pulse energy at the pulse, one pulse 100 femtoseconds long, and there the typical pulse energy is 3 to 5 millijoule.
Millijoule. It does compare to a laser kind of of equipment. Okay, so then it explodes basically the sample.
Yes, absolutely does. Absolutely. And therefore you have to think in, and I think that's the exciting part. You have to think in new strategies, how to do, what kind of experiments are actually possible.
Yeah.
And for some of the experiments, I could, for instance, take high energy density where they prepare this diamond anvil cell and they cost a lot of money and a lot of time. And then you might shoot on it and it's gone within 100 femtoseconds. So the sample production rate has to be high. You could not come with one precious sample and then it would last for a long time.
Oh yeah, of course.
Most likely not the case.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
George Philip raised his hand.
Thank you. How do you cope with the users under the COVID situation? I mean, most probably your locals, they can enter the premises with some restrictions, so this is no problem. But what happens if there is a team of foreign users and they actually have an approved proposal? Can they show up or how do you do it?
We have a relatively simple rule saying if they're allowed into Germany, they're also allowed to come on site. So if you are allowed to travel from Hungary to Germany, then we would also take you on site. But unfortunately, that limits quite a lot at the moment, because I don't think you are allowed to fly from Hungary to Germany, because Hungary is a risk area. So what happens is, and we have had a few groups, they actually say, okay, we go to Germany. We isolate ourselves, we go in quarantine for 2 weeks before we go to European Expo, and that we allow. But of course, to be honest, it's extremely complicated, because if you would go from Hungary to Germany, I'm not sure at a hotel would allow people from risk areas to come. So it's all these kind of practical difficulties. But if you're allowed to Germany, you could come.
Okay, thank you very much.
Grazie. My name is Dio Zagorov from the Biological Research Center, Szeged. And so we are working with microcrystals, for example. The main problem is how to match the crystallography data with the spectroscopic data. Crystallography will tell us the structure, spectroscopy will tell us the function. But you cannot do crystallography on two small samples, and you cannot do spectroscopy on two large crystals. So this is typically what I think the X-FEL may help us, because then we can put in the JET microcrystals. The problem is, part of the problem is that the microcrystals come together with a lot of dissolved material. So in spectroscopy, we can discriminate and we can see what is sort of the debris, which is in the solution, and what is in the microcrystal. I think it would be also possible, probably based on the scattering, to see the microcrystals. There would be another way to check it for sure, which we also apply in spectroscopy, is to orient the samples. So we can orient these microcrystals quite well in 1-2 Tesla magnetic field or in a relatively small electric field. And I think even the JET itself, as it spits out the sample, may introduce some orientation already. So I wonder if a controlled orientation would be possible in the sampling environment and to do the scattering in that manner.
Yes, I mean, first, we have not done any orientation as far as I know, because our philosophy, and I think that has been proven, that you don't need it, because as long as you have enough data, you can always sort afterwards. So, but of course, it could be thought about. High magnetic fields, I'm not sure about electric fields, could be, but it would need a specialized sample setup. But that's, of course, not impossible. Concerning the spectroscopy, we had recently a very successful spectroscopy experiment on FXE. So you cannot do spectroscopy and scattering at the same time, at least not at the same instrument. But of FXE, we had a very successful spectroscopy experiment together with some American colleagues, and they were very excited by the quality of data they got, because it really looked like synchrotron data. It was fantastic. And they could see differences.
Sorry, you mean optical spectroscopy or
X-ray.
Oh yeah, but I meant optical spectroscopy. Sorry.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah.
No, but okay. We can do the optical spectroscopy.
That's a good point. I can check. Maybe it's possible. But the best is maybe if you send me an email, and then I don't know whether you have been in contact with some of our instrument scientists, because otherwise I can make the link.
No, not yet. So we have tried some other means, but also in California at Stanford we had one shot. But that didn't work, but it is just too far.
Then it would be much easier to engage with us somehow, also to be part of maybe a community proposal to get, to get into the business, come here to stay here for some time, talk to the people. I think that's simply the best way.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you.
Could you explain to us outsiders, what do you mean by community proposal?
community proposal is that, for instance, we want to do a commissioning experiment for some kind of special techniques. And then we invite everybody to see, everybody who would be interesting, please come and join. And then we, somebody will come with samples, somebody would come with some expertise, somebody would could do the data analysis. And then you have maybe 10 groups doing the participating in doing one experiment. And that has been quite successful. It sort of matures these kind of experiments. They have a relatively high success rate in our proposal system, and everybody is on board. And you saw some of the publications I showed. There's quite a lot of co-authors, because here in the beginning you need a lot of expertise to make a successful experiment. So therefore, we typically, in particular in structured biology, there's about 50, 60 people on every proposal.
So you mean that would it be a way to do it that sort of we apply with a seed proposal? That is to say, describing what we want, but we don't have the team. I mean,
yes.
So a seed proposal could be a good start then.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
Oh, great! Thank you.
Any more questions, please?
And just joining to this question, if you have that seed proposal, then who will organize the group?
That is normally done by our leading scientists. So they sort of try to structure this proposal. They often arise, for instance, at a users meeting. There are specialized sessions, specialized workshops for each instrument, and that's a good place to join, because they often the origin of such proposals. That's where people get together and say, ah, we need to do such a proposal. Unfortunately, this will be online this year, because it's of course always much better to talk and meet in person to have these discussions. But that hopefully will be from in 22.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry, would it be a form to join the user meeting and to present the seed proposal there?
Yeah, could be. Yes.
Because then all the experts are supposedly be there, and then okay. Oh, great. Yeah. Thank you.
Maybe what I could also suggest, not for next year, but hopefully for 22, is we had we have two successful meetings now with the Spanish user community. We had a special Spanish user workshop connected to our user workshop in January this year. We have also organized a special workshop with Italy, and there's an Italian workshop, of course, online end of the year. So we could maybe do a special workshop, Hungarian workshop, in particular when people can travel again, that we do a Hungarian workshop here, where we invite Hungarian scientists to come. Of course, our Hungarian staff would also be there, and sort of get the group together. That has worked quite well with the other. And there, I don't know if there is something like a Hungarian synchrotron or neutron community organization, then that would be a good starting point to get a contact with them, seen from our perspective.
Yeah, there is one.
Yeah.
Okay, is there any more questions, comments, either about XFEL or Hungary, a contribution, Hungarian contribution? If this is not the case, then final words from Robert.
Thank you very much for all these questions. I hope that I would be able to come to Hungary, and then I would very much like to have a what we call road trip, where I visit the different institutes. I will not come only for a day, maybe for a week, to get a good feeling for what is actually going on at the different institutes. It's for me, it's much better to visit physically and see what's going on. I could, of course, look at your web pages, but that's simply not the same. So I hope that I can come and meet you in person.
Okay. Thank you very much for all of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I close the session.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.